company.
The Chronicles of the American Civil War begins now. And here's your host, Bob O'Connor.
The years creep slowly by.
Welcome to our podcast. My name is Bob O'Connor. This is week 13. We've been here a whole quarter of a year. Time sure flies when you're having fun. And thanks to all you listeners who have made it possible, I am having fun. Welcome back to Claude Jennings, my producer. He did so well sitting in the last two programs that he got a raise, and he's now assigned to the podcast. Welcome.
Thank you.
You'll do fine. I've been thinking back to something Steve French said about McNeil's Rangers several programs ago. Steve said, in the first 15 months of action, McNeil's Raiders never had even one casualty. That is so phenomenal. I know, for instance, that Major General Edward Johnson's Confederate division at Gettysburg had over 1,800 casualties in 36 hours. For McNeil's Rangers to not lose even one soldier over a 15-month span is simply amazing. Of course, Steve did say their tactics include hit and run and getting as quickly away from the action as possible as they could. It must have worked. For those new to the podcast, I will repeat just a few bits of information about this podcast. Our plan is to bring a myriad of experts on many Civil War-related subjects to these airways in a weekly forum as we broadcast from the podcast studio of the soon-to-be world-famous and now newly renovated Chatter Restaurant, 5247 Wisconsin Avenue Northwest, Washington, D.C., right at the Maryland, D.C. line, and across the street from the Friendship Heights Metro Station. We come to you almost live at a location where you can dine in and watch our live podcast as we record if you wish, and we welcome you to do that. Logistically, the podcast will post on Thursday each and every week. You can listen to the programs on iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, and Google Play, but you already know that because you're listening. If you want to contact the program to offer support, ask a question, suggest a speaker, or correct the information that we provide, send an email to chronicles@BobO'ConnorBooks.com. We are also on Facebook at the Chronicles of the American Civil War. Today's look at a Bob O'Connor book is about a historical novel called Southern Oasis at Gettysburg. The book is about the northernmost Confederate hospital located across the street from Culp's Hill on Hanover Road. Over 1,800 casualties of Major General Edward Johnson's division of the Second Corps of the Confederacy, the Army of Northern Virginia, were cared for in the house and barn on the Daniel Lady Farm. Although a novel, every single character of the book is listed in the regimental registry as being camped at the farm and were casualties at Culp's Hill. An interesting feature of the book is a section at the end that gives a footnoted account to what happened to each person after the war. Some of the highlights of the book include the discovery of two women dressed like men who marched with the Second Corps at Gettysburg, the story of a hometown lad, Wesley Culp, who marched with the Confederacy and was killed in Gettysburg, the story of the destruction of a foundry and blacksmith shop owned by Pennsylvania Congressman Thaddeus Stevens near Chambersburg by Confederate General Jubal Early and his men. For information on this book and my other books, please visit my website at www.BobO'ConnorBooks.com. By the way, books ordered on my website prior to December 15th will be delivered by December 25th to addresses in the United States. Delivery to foreign countries is not guaranteed by that date. You're listening to the Chronicles of the American Civil War. This is Bob O'Connor. We'll be right back. Today's guest is Kevin Rawlings, author of the book We Are Marching on Christmas Day, A History and Chronicle of Christmas During the Civil War. And for those present in the studio today, you notice that Kevin also portrays Civil War Santa Claus. Welcome, Kevin.
Hello, Bob. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's really good to have you here. I felt like I was driving the sleigh bringing you in here today.
Just one of the team of reindeers, my friend.
There you go. Could you please introduce yourself to my listeners and tell them how you took on the persona of Santa Claus?
Well, my name is Kevin Rawlings. I originally was from Montgomery County, lived in Sharpsburg, which is actually where I was living at the time that I took on the persona of the Thomas Nast Patriotic Civil War Santa Claus. I was a member of a civilian organization, one of the founding members, called the Frederick Ladies Relief Society. And for the first year that Antietam was going to do their illuminations at the battlefield for all the 23,000 casualties, as a reminder of the cost of war, they had asked us to do Christmas activities outside the Moomaw Farm, where we were ice skating, putting up a Christmas tree, and since I had my own beard, I thought I would look to find out what Santa Claus looked like during that time. So I actually had a little pewter statue that the Duncan Royale Company had done, because they had done a series of statues. In fact, they're now into Series 3, or were into Series 3, where they had Santa Claus through history, and one of them was the Civil War Santa Claus. So that image actually was kind of skinny, was a fairly skinny Santa. So, but that's what we based the outfit that I currently wear today. And then later on, when I was doing a lot of research to find other images, we came across the Thomas Nast front page on Harper's Weekly, which was dated January 3rd, 1863, Christmas of 1862, which was a propaganda piece. No ifs, ands, or buts about it, because it shows Santa sitting on the back of a sleigh, passing out Christmas boxes to the soldiers. And one soldier in that illustration, you see him pulling out a Christmas stocking with candy cane in it, and others are pulling theirs out. Way in the background, you also see soldiers that were playing Christmas games, which they actually did outside of Falmouth, Virginia, following the Battle of Fredericksburg and other places, where you had a soldier who would, you had a group of soldiers chasing a greased pig, and the soldier who could catch that slippery swine would get $4 prize money, which today doesn't sound like a lot of money, but right, back then was quite a bit. You also see soldiers that were climbing a greased pole for the money purse. It was out on top of the pole, and other soldiers are playing football, although I dare say it's not the NFL version that we know today, and also cooking Christmas dinner, too. And they've also had erected an evergreen arch that said, "Welcome Santa Claus." And there was a product placement in the picture, too, because there was an article that was called Santa Claus Among Our Soldiers, and it said, "Children, you mustn't think that Santa comes to visit you alone, for he also visits our soldiers in the field." And so it also said, "Santa's brought lots of Harper's Weekly, so both you lads and lassies can get a peek at the Christmas number," because not only did he do the front page, he also did the centerfold illustration that was there.
So could you describe to those who are not in studio today what you look like as Civil War Santa Claus?
Well, I'm wearing a coat of dark blue, or that was made from a fatigue blouse that has white stars and white fur trim. The Duncan Royale statue actually made it look like where I have a gold loop on my shoulder for the braid that a lot of generals would wear and things like that. I've got a red wool hat with white fur trim and a gold tassel hanging off of it. And I'm wearing red and white striped pants and big black boots. Real boots, not naugahyde.
And a real beard.
And a real long beard. Yes, indeed.
I just learned something myself already. I did not know that you were there at the Antietam Illumination, first time of the event, which I helped initiate in Sharpsburg.
Well, it actually, they canceled it the one night because it was blowing
right
so hard, and they were worried that the illuminations
right
would be bent over and burned, so we ended up doing it indoors. But, in fact, somebody sent me a piece of tape from the news broadcast from Channel 25 time. So.
How about that? I know that in lore, Santa predates the American Civil War by centuries. Can you give us a background of Santa's history and how old you actually are?
Well, actually, the image of Santa Claus or Saint Nicholas, which is used interchangeably at the beginning of the 19th century, actually dates back to more than a millennium. So the real Saint Nicholas was born in 272 AD in the city of Patara in what was then known as the country of Lycia, which is now present-day Turkey. Eventually, he became the Bishop of Myra, and that is how he became known as the gift giver or the miracle maker. Because actually, in Patara, where he got his start as a gift giver, his parents, who were of Greek origins, had died during one of the many epidemics that swept through that land. But also there was a merchant who had fallen on hard times and had three daughters that were of marriageable ages. And in those days, if you couldn't provide dowries for them to marry respectably, you either had to sell them into a life of slavery or a life of prostitution, which was not a very nice future to look forward to. So on three separate nights, Nicholas, who was a young man, who knew he wanted to go in the church, so his uncle was his keeper, he crept up through the window on three separate nights and threw a bag of gold coins in the window. And on the third night, as the legend goes, it had grown up around Nicholas. One of the gold coins bounced out and landed in a stocking that was hanging at the foot of the bed. But the merchant who was lying in wait on the third night to find out who his secret benefactor was chased him through the streets of Patara and eventually caught Nicholas, and he begged him to keep his identity a secret. And from then on, the image of St. Nicholas or Santa Claus has always been the mysterious person who arrives on December 24th to leave his presents underneath Christmas trees and in Christmas stockings, or long time ago in the shoes of Dutch children.
Right. How about that? Can you give us a synopsis of who the cartoonist Thomas Nast was and how his drawings influence what our current thoughts are about Christmas, and this all happened during the American Civil War?
Well, Thomas Nast was born in 1841 in Landau in what is now Germany. His father was a military musician. So in 1846, Mr. Nast, the elder Nast, sent his wife and children to America, and which he ended up emigrating 4 years later, because he'd kind of gotten caught up in some of the political troubles that were racking Germany at the time. And he became the elder Nast became a musician in some of the theaters that were down in New York in the theater district. And in fact, he used to take Nast, the younger Nast, Thomas, with him. And young Mr. Nast would draw pictures of people that were in the audience and what was going on in the stage. And so eventually his talent was recognized, so they ended up sending him to one of the School of Design and Illustration there that was in New York City. He joins the pages of Frank Leslie's Illustrated, one of the two national weekly newspapers, which was sort of the forerunner to People magazine in this day and age. After Frank Leslie had tasked him to go out into the crowd and bring me back a drawing of what was going on in some of the docks of New York, and he came back and he was just overawed with the talent of this young man. So eventually he will join the pages of Harper's Weekly for about a year or so and then go overseas to witness one of the world prize fighting contests that were going on in England. I think it was the Thomas Heenan fight and between that and somebody else. Eventually after that ends, he goes over to Europe, to Italy, to follow the return of Giuseppe Garibaldi, who will raise troops in America here during the Civil War and will follow his revolution there in Italy as they start to pull together all the papal states from the former Vatican and the unification of Italy. And eventually Nast will come back. He will marry his wife, who was from a well-to-do family, and he rejoins the pages of Harper Weekly in Christmas of 1862. Now, at Christmas time, and he does wonderful battlefield illustrations. He does one that's popular called the Union Standard Bearer, where he's holding the flag, which became very popular, and many people will put that up on their walls at home. These are wonderful illustrations, artwork, if you will. And at Christmas time, Fletcher Harper asked Thomas Nast to do a picture that showed the wartime effort as well as what was going on at the home front. Well, he has a little bit of illustrator's block at the time, and his sister, who happens to be a school teacher in the New York City schools, whatnot, tells Thomas Nast about the children's favorite poem, which happened to be A Visit from St. Nicholas, or 'Twas the Night Before Christmas. And this fires his imagination, so he comes up with this patriotic Santa Claus visiting the soldiers in the field. Interestingly enough, it is a propaganda piece. It was in order to serve notice to the South that we have Santa on our side and you don't. And the South never did counter with their own propaganda or patriotic version. They subscribed to the more Kris Kringle or St. Nicholas image. But then his illustration arrives on January 3rd, 1863. Interestingly enough, the editor of the Richmond Examiner on Christmas Day writes an editorial, because he must have been prescient on what was coming. He will write, "We have nothing to chime about the non-arrival of Santa, for he's nothing more than a Dutch toy merchant, an inflated scrub from New England, an immigrant from England, and has nothing more to do with genuine Virginia hospitality and Christmas merrymaking than a Hottentot." Guess you can guess what he got for Christmas. So anyway, but he also does the centerfold, which if you look at it, looks like a pair of binocular lenses. So in one lens, you have the soldier, the husband, in a cold, frosty picket camp in the Army of the Potomac, looking at a glass ambrotype of his wife and children, wishing he was at home. And in the other lens, you have his wife praying before a cold, frosty window. You can see the spires of the churches in the background from the city landscape, while the children are abed in the background. You can see that I have been there because their stockings are filled. There's a drum hanging off the mantelpiece where they're sleeping. Also in the upper corner where you make the adjustment for the binocular lenses is George Washington's tomb, because both sides would claim the patriotism of George Washington for the patriotism for the war effort, both North and South. And in the pivot point down below, we have the tombstones of soldiers who have given their ultimate and will never be home for Christmas again. But in the upper right-hand corner, we have a picture of me driving through the camp, throwing out Christmas boxes to the soldiers who are gleefully running after them. And as the article says, and you see what they contain on page one, the front page. On the other side, there's a metropolitan setting with me on top of a roof getting ready to jump down the chimney. Down below, we also have a Christmas battle at sea. In fact, on Christmas Day in 1861, the Confederates will cross the Potomac River and attack Fort Frederick at Big Pool, Maryland, to try and break up the canal, and they are driven off by the Union soldiers there. And then on the other side, on the right-hand corner, on the lower side, is a Christmas storm at sea. In fact, on December 30th, 1862, the Monitor will sink off the coast of Cape Hatteras, North Carolina. So, also, we have out in the Confederacy, too, just not to overlook that side. We also have before the Battle of Murfreesboro or Stone River begins on December 31st, New Year's Eve, stops for New Year's Day and concludes on the 2nd of January with two very different conclusions. On December 31st, the Confederates have won a smashing victory, but they lose the battle on the 2nd of January. But in between time, before Christmas in Murfreesboro, the whole town is awash with evergreen swaggings and wreaths all over with the triple B's for Buckner, Bragg, and Breckinridge, the former Vice President of the United States. And there's a lot of dances going on, too, and there's a lot of but only the officers are allowed to attend. So there's a lot of borrowing by hook or by crook by common soldiers to borrow off officer's uniform so they can go in and meet and dance with the ladies. And then after, and John Hunt Morgan also gets married before Christmas to Maddie Reedy, the local Murfreesboro girl. And then the next morning, after his honeymoon, he jumps on his horse and rides off on the first Christmas invasion of Kentucky for Christmas of 1862.
Very good. Could you talk a little bit about your book, originally published in 1995, called We Were Marching on Christmas Day, A History and Chronicle of Christmas During the Civil War?
Well, the first chapter deals with many of our Christmas customs and traditions that came to this country from the various ethnic groups that brought them. Three of the main ones would be the British, the Dutch, and the Germans, too, which would provide the Christmas trees. The Dutch would bring the very first of the images of St. Nicholas to this country. And the English will bring Christmas greens, Christmas caroling, and various other aspects of the Christmas customs and traditions that we know today. Eventually, Christmas trees would become popular in the 1830s, 1840s, in many of the metropolitan centers that many of the German immigrants are coming to this country, but also with the evolution of Santa Claus from the image of St. Nicholas, who at the beginning of the 19th century is still dressed in his bishop's robes in a wonderful broadside that John Pittard, who is the founder of the New York Historical Society, the American Bible Society, one of the first savings banks in New York City, because he is looking to find a holiday. He first starts with Christmas, but he doesn't like that because there's a lot of drunken revelry and going on. In fact, many of the metropolitan centers will have something that is called mumming or masking, in which there would be rude displays of pantomime going to the upper level of society's doors and knocking on their doors for change and small beer or for the wassail bowl, which is a reference of the old Christmas coming over from England, in which the baron or the lord of the manor would provide a Christmas bowl and cakes for the people, the tenant farmers of his estate. Then the other chapters deal with each year of the war through the illustrations of many of the known artists, Thomas Nast, Winslow Homer, Alf Woad, and many others, Sol Eitinge, names that have been lost to history as, you know, time has moved on, but to have these wonderful illustrations. Long before Winslow Homer was a painter, he was an illustrator for Harper's Weekly. So in fact, in 1858, he's showing a picture of Santa Claus on the front page of Harper's Weekly, as well as drawing images of a gentleman handing out Christmas ornaments, which were real instruments that could be played by the children from a Christmas tree. So, but also through the letters and diaries and soldiers and civilians on all sides of the conflict and the wide array of emotions and experiences they had at Christmas time from 1862 to after the war ended in 1865.
I believe the book A Visit from St. Nick was published before the Civil War. How did that book influence those traditions?
Well, actually, it got its start in the newspapers, because in 1823, and this is predated by a children's book, actually in 1821, called The Children's Friend. And it showed Santa Claus with it emblazoned on his hat with only one, count him, one reindeer. It was published by William Gilley in New York City, who's one of his favorite patrons of his bookstore happened to be Clement Clark Moore. But this is also the children's book. It was an 8-page children's book that showed him going through the houses and filling out the stockings. As he says, some stockings whitely, nice and cleaned and neatly mended, and others as if for pigs intended that had holes in them. And, of course, the trinkets would fall through in the holes and things like that. And at the end, showing a stocking that had long black birchen rod switches in it, because actually Clement Clark Moore, which he may have actually written that, although it's also been put forth that James K. Paulding may have written that also. But then in 1823, the editor of the Troy Sentinel, who has the unlikely holiday name of Orville L. Holly, he receives his poem anonymously in the mail. So he reads it, and he writes an editorial in which he writes, "We know not to whom we are indebted for that following description of the unwearied patron of children, Santa Claus, as he goes about the firesides of this happy land, laden with Christmas bounties, but from whomsoever it may have come, we give thanks for it and hope both you lads and lassies have many a Merry Christmas." And he's the one that entitles it being an account of a visit from St. Nicholas. Interestingly enough, the names of the reindeer are just a touch, two of them are just a touch different than the ones that we know today, because we have Dasher, Dancer, Prancer, Vixen, Comet, Cupid, and we have Dunder, and Blixem with an X.
Blixem. Dunder and Blixem. It doesn't rhyme quite as well, does it?
No, but it's Dutch for thunder and lightning.
Oh.
And okay. Later on, there'll be many changes to that poem through the years, and it'll get changed to the Germanic Donder and Blitzen. But also, interestingly enough, those reindeers were named after famous racehorses at the time period. But there's also a controversy, too, on if whether it was Clement Clark Moore that actually wrote it or a gentleman who was a Revolutionary War veteran by the name of Major Henry Livingston, who lived in Poughkeepsie. He wrote a number of verses in the same rhyme scheme and meter as A Visit from St. Nicholas, which was a famous anapest form of poetic writing. Clement Clark Moore wrote poetry, but he was never known as being a very happy gentleman. He was kind of stern and rather dour. In fact, according to the story that he may have written that, he was rather embarrassed by regret when this appeared in the newspaper, the Troy Sentinel. And so for his name would not appear on that until after 1837, when a group of poems that were published, Christmas poems, included A Visit from St. Nicholas. So by that time, Major Henry Livingston was long dead. The other interesting thing, which also gets changed, because at the end of A Visit from St. Nicholas, I was heard to exclaim, "Ere he drove out of sight." What do you think it says?
Merry Christmas to all, and to all a good night.
No, it was not. Originally, it was a happy Christmas to all, and to all a good night. So, but it's, that has been changed, too. So, but and that, one of the other keys to that is Major Henry Livingston, when he was sparking the lady who would become his wife, he, at the holidays, he would write her numerous love letters that at the end would say, "A happy Christmas to you, my dear, and many more to come." So now, the one piece of evidence that may have been that would have been persuasive that Livingston wrote that burned up in a house fire in 1850 in Minnesota. So the hand copy, the handwritten copy that he wrote is gone and no longer exists. So Moore would never quite remember when he wrote that poem. He always would write, "A poem I wrote a very long time ago." So. So, in fact, he writes a copy in 1862 for a young lady. He dies in the middle of the summer of 1863. But after the publication in 1823 in the Troy Sentinel, a few more papers pick it up, the Troy Budget the following year. By the time we get to the Civil War, it's an annual national tradition to publish the verses of A Visit from St. Nicholas. Post-war in 1866, when Nass does his wonderful illustration in the center of the Christmas number, as it is known, of Santa Claus and his works, on the back side of that centerfold are the verses of A Visit from St. Nicholas.
So what does Kevin Rawlings think of who actually wrote the poem?
There's a website dedicated to Major Henry Livingston. Actually, I was on my way to a book signing some years back in York, Pennsylvania, and I heard this interview with a gentleman by the name of Don Foster, who wrote a book called Author Unknown. And he wrote a number of some of his chapters dealt with some of his work. He was a professor, I can't remember at the university he was at, but he wrote, he was brought in for the Ted Kaczynski Unabomber case. He had supposedly found a couple of poems that he said that it was actually Shakespeare that wrote those, so they were added to the Shakespeare canon. But one chapter he dealt with was, he got into the controversy on who may have actually written A Visit from St. Nicholas. He came down man on the side that it was actually Major Henry Livingston. And I kind of if swayed that way. I'm sort of back in the middle ground because not quite sure. Even American Heritage Magazine or the books that came out every month got into that. They wrote a little ditty on over the controversy and who may have actually written that poem.
How about that? Some of our Christmas traditions today come from the American Civil War, including decorating the Christmas tree. Can you expand a little bit on that?
Actually, the Christmas trees came from many of the German immigrants coming to this country during the 1830s and 1840s and introducing many of the metropolitan centers to the decorated wonders of the Christmas tree. Actually, Christmas trees go back much farther to they were erected in front of cathedrals, and they were decorated with communion wafers, and the images of Adam and Eve and the serpent were placed underneath the Christmas tree, and they were part of miracle plays that were performed in front of those cathedrals. Also in old English cathedrals, too, we also had music that was coming about St. Nicholas and his good works, too. But getting back to the Christmas trees, actually the very first Christmas tree document was about a description of a woman in Salzburg who erected a Christmas tree, and I believe, in 1637. And she set it up in her drawing room. She closed the doors to keep the kids out, put little tapers on the Christmas tree, and put other little ornaments, and put the kids' Christmas tree packages underneath, and threw open the door, in which they were overawed with that. Eventually, more places would start to, in Germany, and start to spread all throughout Latvia, or what is today Latvia, and some of the Baltic states, too, and eventually will make its way to England when Queen Victoria marries the German-born Prince Albert. But before that happens, as Princess Elizabeth, she had seen Christmas trees set up in some of the palaces that she lived in. In fact, George III's wife, Queen Charlotte, set up a Christmas tree about 1803 in Windsor Castle that was made out of a yew tree. And so we have English royalty having Christmas trees there, too. And it was only the royalty that could afford, you know, Christmas trees and decorating them. Eventually, though, when Prince Albert comes along, he first sets up a Christmas tree in Windsor Castle in 1841. And he starts giving out Christmas trees to schools and academies and military barracks. So he starts spreading the Christmas tree tradition through England, and it also makes its way over across into America, too. So, in fact, in 1851, Reverend Henry Swan, who has a church in Cleveland, Ohio, sets up one in his church, and his congregation nearly mutinies on him, considering it a pagan symbol of old Christmas. So he thinks very fast and finds a reference in the Bible, and then they take him at his word, and he's able to do that. Eventually, churches will also erect Christmas trees and charge the tourists that come in there to view the various decorations of the Christmas tree. The Christmas trees that we know today, where there are close, packed, dense Christmas trees back then, they were wide spaces because they lit their Christmas trees with little tapers or candles. In fact, the illustration of Prince Albert's Christmas tree appears in 1848 in the Illustrated London News, and it is 7 feet tall and made taller still by the European practice of placing it on a table, and it has a multitude of tapers and a hand-blown glass Nuremberg angel at the top. In 1850, that rare woman editor of an American magazine, Godey's Ladies Book, she'll take that illustration, rip off Prince Albert's mustache, which must have hurt terribly, gets rid of his sash, Queen Victoria's crown, and she will have her illustrator Americanize that illustration. And that will appear in 1850 in Godey's Ladies Book and reappear in 1860 on the eve of the war with an article on how to decorate a Christmas tree. Now, this is spreading out through the North and the South. In fact, Jenny Lind, who comes over here, the Swedish songstress, whose P.T. Barnum is her agent, she has a Christmas tree erected outside of her hotel room in Savannah, Georgia, when she appears down there. But many Southern mothers are only just first trying their first Christmas trees during the Civil War. One of the first ones appears in 1841 in Williamsburg and 1846 in Richmond. And people will come from miles around to view its decorated wonders. But many of those mothers are trying the first ones in letters and diaries during the Civil War. And many of the ornaments were homemade. In the Pennsylvania Dutch area, there's an example in Winterthur, the museum up there, that has an upside-down Christmas tree in order to keep the mice from crawling up there and eating the handmade, the dough ornament Christmas tree, or the Christmas ornaments. So
would they have had Christmas trees in their camps in the Civil War?
Actually, they would. In 1861, Alfred Bellard from the 5th New Jersey writes about a Christmas tree that's erected outside his camp, and it's decorated with the crackers, the hardtack, salt pork, and oranges. And then he talks about the band coming in, playing some of the new Christmas airs that were being written just before, during, and after the war. And as he says, when the band arrived in camp, we had more rubber in our heels than formerly when we went out and marched. And then in 1862, in the camps outside of Falmouth, Virginia, after the Battle of Fredericksburg, after they'd been killing each other with wanton disregard, although at Christmas time they're curious about one another and floating ships across the Rappahannock River, the Confederates sending over five and 6 pound twists of tobacco, and the Union soldiers sending back a pound of coffee and the latest newspapers, which will make their way up to General Lee. But the Irish Brigade also erects a Christmas tree in their camp, and they decorate it again with hardtack, salt pork, and their tin cups, of which they've been imbibing Irish whiskey from. So you have all this going on. So, in fact, one lady in 1862, Ella Gertrude Clanton Thomas of Augusta, Georgia, will set up her very first Christmas tree. But the following year, she does something strange, too. She will throw a Christmas party for her children in lieu of Santa's coming, because she said Santa won't be able to get through the blockade that year. Which is basically the secret that we can't afford the exorbitant prices of the toys and other goods for making Christmas merrymaking that are in the shops because of the blockades beginning to strangle the South. So she throws this party for them, and just as the faith in kids for Santa Claus is still going to be able to make it, they hang up their stockings anyway. When she goes up to tuck them in, she sees the stockings there, and so she digs a little deeper, finds a few trinkets, an orange or two for their stockings, and some cakes and other articles, and when they wake up the next morning, they are none the wiser.
There you go. Good deal. I had read about an incident of charity in Sherman's army near Savannah, where they took mules and they attached tree branches to them to make them look like reindeer antlers.
Oh, that's one of my favorite stories I tell. Despite the hard hand of war, once Sherman's army got to Savannah, Georgia, whatnot, members of a Michigan regiment will load up this perishable foodstuffs for the devastated countryside and tie those branches to the heads of mules to make them look like reindeer. And these Santa Clauses go out among the devastated countryside and giving out these foodstuffs to the populace that is outside of Savannah, Georgia. So
that's great.
It's also a bittersweet Christmas for General Sherman, too, because he finds out, not through a letter from home, from his wife especially, but through the newspaper, that the child who's been born to him that he has never seen has died. So it's a bittersweet, because he's having to host his staff at Christmas parties and things like that. So you can imagine the inner turmoil that's going on within General Sherman.
Wow.
Also, there were Christmas trees in the White House, because after all, Abraham Lincoln did have children, so they did have Christmas trees there. In fact, the very first Christmas tree in the White House happened underneath the during the administration of Franklin Pierce in 1856, in which he will invite a local Sunday school and give out presents from underneath the decorated Christmas tree in the White House. Eventually, the very first Christmas tree that was electrically lit happened during the administration of Grover Cleveland. And it was Edison's little bulbs, or big bulbs, right, at the time, that were part of that.
Thomas Edison. Mm-hmm. Yep. You have portrayed Civil War Santa for over 20 years. Can you share with us some of your favorite tales of what has happened to you?
I've had a number of things that have happened. One year, I happened to be at Monocacy Battlefield, and I was there, and this harried mother came in. And she said, "I just want to let you know I have a little hellion for you, kid, whatnot, because last week he ripped off Santa's beard in the mall and threw it on the floor." Well, I looked at her and I said, "Well, if he rips my beard off, I'm going to cry." And she said, "Why is that?" I said, "Because it's attached."
Yeah.
Well, sure enough, he came in, climbed up on my lap, and he reached out. And when his hands hit the hairs of my beard, he turned around wide-eyed to his mother and said, "It's the real one."
There you go.
So then when another year, I think it was also at Monocacy, I had two little girls that came in, although I'm sure they're not little any longer. The first one said she wanted a baby grand piano because they were pianists. They took piano lessons. And then the second one climbed up, and she, too, said she wanted a baby grand piano. So I told her it was going to be very packed in the sleigh this year of baby grand pianos and cars, too, because I got a lot of adults going, "Hey, did you forget that Mercedes I won for Christmas last year?" So, and a few I still can play around with, too, and said, "You're still looking for that pony I gave you for Christmas? You never found it in your bedroom? My gracious. You must have been having to muck out the bedroom." So, but I've had some, too. I get some heartbreaking ones, too, when a child climbs up, especially with some of the financial problems that we've had in this country, and fathers that have lost jobs and are without, that will climb up and I says, "I don't want anything for Christmas this year, Santa, except for you to find my father a job." Or if the parents are bickering quite a bit at Christmas time, as some do, to try to make peace with the parents,
wow,
and make them,
that's pretty,
make them have a happier Christmas.
Heavy.
Those are hard ones to try and come up with an answer to assure a kid.
You actually portray three different Santas. Can you describe each and how they differ?
Well, the very first one, I did start it off with the Thomas Nast Patriotic Civil War Santa Claus. Eventually, I got what I call the traditional modern Santa. Although, I do want to ask you, do you know what the difference between a Coca-Cola Santa and the traditional modern Santa is?
No, I don't.
All right. Well, the traditional modern Santa that I do has a fur coat, fur mantle on it, fur all the way down.
And he drinks Pepsi.
No. Yeah. Well, I guess, yeah. Now, the Coca-Cola Santa Claus has no fur that goes up and down his coat. He only has brass buttons. And do you know how that got started?
No, I don't.
In 1931, advertising artist Haddon Sombom had the account for Coca-Cola, and he would paint a number of canvases every year, and has a Coca-Cola either in Santa's hand, right, for the paws that refreshes, or through the years, because he would paint those paintings for Coca-Cola, and they would decide which one's going to go for the advertising campaigns each year. And he does that until 1966. I'm still stuck in the 19th century. In 1964, and although they have several more, they use up until 1966. And they would appear in such periodicals as Saturday Evening Post, Life, Look, Newsweek, Time, National Geographic would feature all those. And some of those paintings, he would be seen looking at a note that was left by the children with a Coca-Cola on it while they're hiding behind the Christmas tree, or him raiding the icebox, whatnot, and pulling out a turkey leg while on others. He's playing with the children's toys at the base of the Christmas tree with the train or with that little helicopter, right, that came about in the 1950s and 1960s. So So he would make Santa a little more a full-size figure, unlike the Nass that was sort of elfish, until later on Nass makes him a little bit bigger. The Nass will standardize him in the 19th century. Samblon will standardize him in the 20th century, because that is all the shopping mall Santas are based upon, the Coca-Cola image.
Right.
So, in fact, many of those Coca-Cola cutouts that stand in the soda pop piles are highly sought after by collectors. You can still find them in antique stores.
Could you please share with
me? Oh, you wanted the other one. The other one is the 1848 Knickerbocker Santa, which is based on the Henry M. Onderdonk, an authorized edition of A Visit from St. Nicholas, with Moore's name on it. And it had the wonderful woodcuts of T.C. Boyd, Theodore C. Boyd. And it showed him with buckle shoes, stockings, which I wear striped stockings, knee breeches, or the buckle, right. You know, like the Revolutionary War pantaloons or pants that came down just over the knees that buttoned, with a waistcoat, a green waistcoat, and a red wool coat with brown fur, and a brown fur, what they call pillbox hat. If you want to know what a pillbox hat, look at some of the pictures of Jackie Kennedy, especially on that fateful day as she was wearing a pillbox hat in Dallas.
Could you tell us where and when you will be appearing as Santa in the upcoming weeks, so those who are not here today can give you their wish list and perhaps get a photograph of you?
I'm appearing in Alexandria as a traditional Santa for a breakfast with Santa Claus at the Carlisle Club. And right after I finish that, I have to run over to Fort Ward on Braddock Road, which is a Civil War, one of the many of the Civil War forts that were a ring around Washington, D.C., that one of the few that still exist. I'll be there from noon to 4, doing dramatic readings of A Visit from St. Nicholas, as well as a parody version that appeared in Godey's Lady Book in 1861 called The Night After Christmas.
I don't think you gave us the date for that.
1861.
No, the date of your appearance.
Oh, that is, what is today? The day is the 7th. That will be on December 9th.
Okay.
On December 10th, I'm in Richmond for a realtor's open house. The following week, I have a private party that I'm doing for somebody, but on the 17th, I believe, I will be at Chatham Manor down at Fredericksburg Battlefield in residence as the Civil War Santa in the Chatham Manor. And that pretty much closes out. I've got a couple other private parties that I'm doing on. I may appear in the streets of Frederick mysteriously to wave at traffic as they're going by and then disappear just as mysteriously again, going, "Where'd he go?" while they're looking for me. So.
Finally, for anyone listening who doesn't believe in Santa Claus, what would you tell them?
Despite not believing in me, especially the children that have gotten to the age as they no longer believe, I believe in them. I believe in each and every one of them. Some of my older customers are recounting their childhood. The oldest lady I've had sitting on my lap was 101, and she had never sat on Santa's lap.
Wow.
So she was going back to her childhood.
That was on her bucket list, huh?
Yep. But I tell some of the older adults, you know, I haven't received a letter from you in quite a while. You haven't stopped believing, have you?
There you go. Could you tell my listeners how to get a copy of your fine book, We Are Marching on Christmas Day?
Well, history? I believe most of the stores do not carry it any longer, but you can probably find it on Amazon, or you can actually get a hold of me, too, at civilwarsanta@gmail.com, and I will arrange to send you a price or send you a book, an autographed copy of the book in the mail.
There you go. Thanks for coming in today. Would you like to come back next week and tell us the rest of your story?
I would be delighted to tell you some further stories of my 1,745 years of existence.
You look pretty good for that, being that old. You've been listening to Civil War Santa, Kevin Rawlings. You're listening to the Chronicles of the American Civil War. We'll be right back. This weekend, several war events include a candlelight Christmas at A.H. Stevens State Park in Crawfordville, Georgia, a lecture about the operation of the Mississippi River Flotilla at the National Civil War Museum in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and holiday tours of Liberia at Manassas, Virginia. Today's little-known fact about the American Civil War is West Virginia was the only state formed during the American Civil War. When Virginia voted to secede, the western counties voted to attempt to form their own state. President Lincoln signed the law to accept West Virginia as a new state on December 31, 1862, the official date of the new state. That the new state came into the Union was June 20th, 1863. Today's expression that came out of the American Civil War is chief cook and bottle washer, which, of course, means the person of in charge. After being at Chatter for 12 weeks now, I'm not sure who the chief cook and bottle washer is here. Today in American Civil War history, December 7th, 1861, Confederate General Thomas J. Stonewall Jackson and his men attempted to destroy the south side of Dam No. 5 on the Potomac River near Williamsport, Maryland, to try to disrupt the water flow in the Chesapeake and Ohio Canal. As you may have heard in Tim Snyder's recent podcast about the Chesapeake and Ohio Canal, most of the Confederate efforts to shut down the canal had very little effect on its overall operations. In the news recently was a report of a movement of an attempt to erect a Civil War statue in Kansas. That is unusual in these days of taking down Civil War statues. The proposed statue is to honor a Concordia, Kansas resident named Boston Corbett. Corbett was the man who fired the shot at the barn in Virginia that killed Lincoln assassin John Wilkes Booth. Even to this day, there is controversy over whether it was actually Corbett who fired the shot. He did, however, receive a portion of the reward money offered by the government. Corbett's share of the $100,000 reward amounted to $1,653.84, which in today's equivalent would be $23,800.44. Corbett has ties to several other recent podcasts of the Chronicles of the American Civil War. Obviously, my interview with Edward Steers Jr. concerning the assassination of Abraham Lincoln, and not so obviously from my interviews with Kevin Fry about Andersonville Prison, where Boston Corbett spent time as a prisoner of war. In another note, I recently met a lady named Elsie, who is a descendant of the Shoemaker family, who owned the 3,000-acre tract called Friendship, located on both sides of Georgetown-Frederick Turnpike, which today is known as Wisconsin Avenue. They owned land on both sides of the district line, and where Chatter today is located. And the area today is known as Friendship Heights. How about that? The family were Quakers, also called Friends. The family was active on the Underground Railroad. Fort Bayard, part of the defenses of Washington during the American Civil War, were also located in Friendship. There is nothing that remains of the fort today except the historical marker near the intersection of River Road and Western Avenue, south of our location here at Chatters. Fort Bayard was one of the over 50 forts that surround the nation's capital. Fort Bayard had four 20-pound Parrott guns and two 12-pound howitzers for its defense. To contact us, please send an email to chronicles@boboconnorbooks.com. I promise I will personally read every single email. Here's an email from Seattle, Washington, the Fine Good family. Thanks for all the interesting information about the Civil War. Our family is learning something each week we had not previously known. Keep up the good work. This email was sent from Tallahassee, Florida, from Gerald Thomas. Wow, I'm so glad that I stumbled upon your podcast in recent weeks. I'm trying to go back and listen to the archive shows. How do you find such interesting guests? Thanks for the question, Mr. Thomas. Every author and scholar who has agreed to appear in the program so far are people I've run across in my travels across the country. And yes, they have certainly been interesting gifts. My producers, Claude Jennings and Mark Stern and myself, marvel at how much we learn from each podcast. And I am pretty well versed on many aspects of the American Civil War. My next email is from Betty Barnhold of Natchez, Mississippi. Greetings. I'm fascinated by the Civil War and all its facets. Your podcast has brought some clarity to issues I had not previously encountered. I am hooked on the Chronicles of the American Civil War. Thanks, Ms. Barnhold. That's a good thing. Here's another email from Mike Faus, F-A-U-S, I hope I pronounced that right, of Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Being from Lancaster, the hometown of James Buchanan, I wish he wasn't such an inept president. Loved the last episode with Frederick Douglass. Here's an email from Pate Hogan, New Madrid, Missouri. Email says, I have enjoyed your podcast about the American Civil War. I have enjoyed learning new things weekly from it. Growing up in New Madrid, Missouri, and still living here, I've always learned about the Battle of Island Number 10. I would love to hear a podcast about the battle for the control of the Mississippi River. Keep up the great pod. It's a great idea. I will add that to the topics of some of our future programs. Here's our final email of the day. I was quite surprised to hear Edward Steers state emphatically in a recent program that Dr. Mudd was a Confederate operative sent to help recruit men to help John Wilkes Booth. I had always thought Dr. Mudd had gotten a raw deal and was completely innocent. Your scholars seem to have done the research that many of us do not have time to do ourselves. I appreciate your programs. That was sent by Bobby Simpson, Denver, Colorado. Tune in next week as my guest will be Kevin Rawlings. We'll be doing part two, the story of the Civil War Christmas. Thanks again to Chatter, my producer Claude Jennings, and today's guest, Kevin Rawlings, who was wonderful. Look for pictures that I will post soon of his visit here today. Thanks to all of you who listen regularly. Tell your friends. Please join us next week at the same time in the same podcast location. You've been listening to the Chronicles of the American Civil War. This is your host, Bob O'Connor.
The years creep slowly by, Lord.